Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. It's very nice to see so many of you here tonight on what is a very busy time of the year for everyone. And as I said, we have a new microphone, so please let me know if you can't hear what's being said. Tonight I'd like to talk on two aspects of practice and also tie it in to two of the annual celebrations which take place at this time of year. The first one is Christmas, and the second one is that at this time of year, on the full moon of December, we celebrate the enlightened nun Sanghamitta Teri, who took the ordination for nuns from India to Sri Lanka. Several hundred years after the Buddha's passing away. And this was the opportunity for the ordination to move out of India to the rest of the world, because from Sri Lanka the ordination for nuns was taken to China and then went to other countries in Northern Asia, and we have that lineage available to us today. So the full moon of December is the time when we remember that event, and when I usually give a teaching from the enlightened nuns. And so that's what I'm going to do today. But I'm also going to tie it in to two strands of practice which are ways of approaching enlightenment. They're not distinct, but they are two strands of the way that we approach enlightenment. And the two terms in Pali, which you may be familiar with or you may be hearing for the first time, the first term is Chaito Vimuti, and the other term is Panya Vimuti. And these two terms denote two approaches to liberation. Vimuti means liberation or freedom. And Chaito Vimuti means liberation of the heart or mind through concentration. And Panya Vimuti means liberation of the mind through wisdom. Chaito is referring to not only the thinking mind, but the feeling heart. And when we talk about the mind in Buddhism, we need to be aware that we're talking not about the thinking analytical mind only. That's the thing that we're familiar with. We're also referring to the feeling heart. We could say the emotional mind. And in the path to liberation, we have to work with the feelings, with the heart, with the emotions. We purify our emotions, we say, because our feeling about things is where we actually live our life. We may think that we are living our life from our thinking analytical brain, but actually it's our heart which really guides us. And so when we are practicing for liberation, we practice to transform the self-centered heart into the wide open, spacious, loving heart, which is open to not only ourselves, but to all beings everywhere. This is one particular aspect of the work that we need to do. The other part of the path to liberation is the wisdom aspect. And the wisdom aspect is based on starting to see things in a new way, closer to reality. And so when we are talking about developing wisdom, we're talking about being able to see our experience in terms of the three characteristics of existence pointed out by the Buddha: anicca, impermanence, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, and anatta, non-self. When we are practicing for liberation, we can't just do the heart work and ignore the wisdom aspect. Similarly, we can't do just the wisdom aspect and ignore the heart. It's, if you are trying to do one without the other, it's like trying to just stand on one leg. You can stand for a while, you can hop for a while, but it's very uncomfortable and you can't sustain it and you're likely to fall over. So we need both of these strands of practice. The purification of the emotions comes through starting to become familiar with our thinking and with the kind of thoughts that go on in the mind, and starting to see whether those, what those thoughts contain, what is their quality, whether they're kind thoughts or hurtful thoughts, whether they're happy thoughts or miserable thoughts, starting to become familiar with what our mind contains and whether or not that brings us peacefulness and happiness. And as we work with the mind, we start to get to know the mind. So we're developing wisdom as well as starting to try and transform the selfish, unhelpful thoughts by cultivating their opposites: loving kindness, compassion, joy in the happiness of others, and equanimity, the four Brahma Viharas, the ways, the means of specifically working on the purification of the mind. But whatever meditation we do, as we start to become familiar with the mind and as we start to spend time not indulging in thinking, not indulging in our views and opinions, but just focusing peacefully on a simple meditation object like the breath, every time we're mindful and we don't indulge in thinking, when we just stay with the breath, that is a moment which is free of greed and hatred. And so that's a moment of purification. So whatever meditation we're doing, even if it's not blissful, just to make the effort to stay with the meditation object and not to feed the thoughts, to indulge in our self-centeredness, because when we observe our thinking, we see our thoughts are all about me, all about us. Might be about something other than me in the middle of it, but it's always how it relates to me. So thinking is constantly feeding our self-centeredness. If we can take up the meditation object and stay for a few moments free of self-centeredness, then we've already started the purification of the mind. Now, particularly how this relates to Christmas. Up at the nuns' monastery, we have a Christmas tree, and particularly the children love to come and see the Christmas tree. And the Christmas tree is a living tree which we have in our garden, which we specially look after for Christmas. And then we cover it with Dharma gifts, sayings of the Buddha and bookmarks and all sorts of nice things, plus a few Christmas touches. And then we also have a table of giveaways there where people can help themselves to Dharma books and tapes and CDs. We like to get in the swing of Christmas, but we try to get in the swing that's positive, that's wholesome. And the part of Christmas which we celebrate and which we can easily celebrate is that theme of giving, of sharing, of generosity. The Christian approach to Christmas is, of course, that this is a time to celebrate because God sent his only Son to save the world. And we may not agree with that or believe it, but just contemplate what a great gift, what a wonderful act of generosity to be willing to do that. And this is the underlying theme of Christmas. That's what the exchange of gifts is all about, to remind us that God was willing to make the ultimate gift and that Christ was willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. Now, as Buddhists, seeing as we live in a predominantly Christian society, I think it's very important that we find things in Christianity that we share, the things that we hold in common. This is something that's useful rather than dwelling on the things that make us different or separate us, but it's also very useful for our children who are growing up in a predominantly Christian culture, that they're able to find ways in which they can join in with the celebrations that are going on and not feel somehow different or separate or not part of the whole thing. So this theme of generosity, this theme of being willing to give up what is precious, this is something which is very familiar to Buddhist practice. And in fact, when the Buddha first taught people who had no understanding of his teaching, he always started with the benefits of generosity. This was something which was a common human experience, to be able to share what we have with those who need it. And in Buddhism, the emphasis is not just on the person who receives the gift, although that's important. And at Christmas time, we particularly think not only of the people that we want to share gifts with because we know them or like them, but people in need who don't have what we have, and the people that we might be able to help by sharing what we have. There is that aspect to the sharing. But in Buddhist practice, being able to share and to give up what we would like to have for ourselves is very important for helping us to overcome our self-centeredness, our greed, and our craving. The Buddha said that the cause of suffering for all of us is our craving. We want. And when we don't get what we want, or we get what we don't want, we suffer. That is the root of our suffering. And being generous is a way of challenging our self-centeredness. It's a way of going against our craving. And it's a fundamental practice that we need to undertake, particularly if we want our meditation to progress. Because the way that craving expresses itself in our ordinary life is that we constantly engage with the world through the senses, through seeing, through hearing, through smelling, through tasting, through touching, and through thinking about things. And that's why we get so exhausted at the end of the day, especially at this time of the year, when there's so much to engage with, so much to take in, so much to have to process. And we're constantly feeding the craving, sensual desire, through engaging with the world through the senses. Now, we can't avoid that because it's the nature of this existence, it's the nature of this mind and body. But what we experience when we sit down to meditate is the same thing is happening even when we don't need to engage with the rest of the world. Even when we don't need to say anything or do anything, we don't need to look at anything, our eyes are closed, we don't need to speak to anyone, we don't need to taste anything, but still we can't stop. And even while we're sitting here, we manufacture so many experiences to do with those things, remembering what we've enjoyed. We had this nice thing to eat last Christmas. Maybe it'll be here this Christmas. We're going to go to this nice place and see this nice thing. The mind is manufacturing all sorts of experiences that have actually passed away or which haven't yet come. But the tendency of the mind is to go out and engage with the world non-stop, even when it's not necessary. And this makes us very tired and stressed, because no matter how much we get, no matter how much we indulge the senses, it's never enough, never ends, we're never satisfied. Always something else that we want. And this makes it very difficult for the mind to settle down in meditation, to be still enough, to start to uncover the happiness within the mind that is not dependent on sense pleasures. To be able to uncover that happiness, we have to be able to turn away from the world long enough to settle the attention inward, to not to have the mind moving out. So as much as we can practice generosity and saying no to our desires, giving up the things that we would like to have, that we would like to use for ourselves, to give it away is a way at undermining the craving. Undermining it so that we can sit in meditation and just for a few moments let go of the world. We train in letting go of the world by generosity. We train in letting go of things that we think we can't do without, but we find through giving them away, through giving them up, through sharing them, that we can do without them. And the mind starts to get the message. In the moment when we're able to be generous, already from within is produced a feeling of satisfaction, happiness. But usually the mind is too coarse to recognize that, to pick it up. We're used to much coarser, stronger feelings that are produced through the senses. Those subtle feelings which come from not getting but through giving only really express themselves clearly once we've calmed down the mind. And so in that moment, we experience there is this inner happiness which is available, which is in my heart and is available to me. So the more that we're able to develop the mind in meditation, the more easily we can find these subtle feelings which aren't dependent on sense contacts or sensual gratification. Now, in the context of Christmas, what we see is a tradition which for many people has lost its meaning. It's lost its meaning as the celebration of the birth of Christ, and it's lost its meaning as a celebration of sharing, of practicing sharing, generosity, giving up. We see a tradition which has been overtaken by materialism. And so what we have for many people is an empty tradition, whether they're Christian or not. The idea of giving gifts is to see what we get back. Or the idea of giving gifts is to see how what that person thinks of me by the quality of the gift that they give to me. Or how I can express my sense of self through what I'm able to give away to other people. There's a lack of giving up and surrendering in that act of giving. So one of the points that I would like to make, and which is part of the theme of this talk, is that what we do is not so important. It's the heart with which we do it. It can look as though we're celebrating Christmas. It can look as though we're being generous. It can look as though we're wishing someone well because we're doing what the tradition demands of us. But that's not beneficial if we're not doing it with a heart that's full of love, full of goodwill, wishing the best for that person, not wishing something in return, not wishing to score points, but simply giving. That doesn't mean we give without wisdom, that we overextend ourselves and give more than we can, more than we can afford. But it means that we don't think that just by doing the action, we're actually gaining the benefit in terms of Buddhist practice. It's the quality of mind that counts, not the outer show. And so part of the cultivation of the mind that's free, the mind that's liberated, starts with becoming aware of where we're bound, becoming aware of the limitations that we place on the giving that we can do, the conditions that we place on the giving that we do, the expectations that we place on the giving that we do. And this we can only know, each of us, for ourselves by paying attention at the time that we're doing it. If we're cultivating the mind in meditation and starting to become more familiar with the thoughts and the emotions that come up, we start to become aware also of the effect, the consequences of those emotions. What do they really bring into my life? What do they really add to my life? This is how we start to develop wisdom, our personal wisdom and understanding. The development of the freedom that comes through the cultivation of concentration comes because we're able to focus inwards, stay with the meditation object, for longer and longer stretches of time without being drawn out to the world outside, this body and mind. And gradually, by finding the peace in the mind, finding a substitute, a replacement for the pleasure that we previously could get only through material gratification, through the senses. We start to find something that is as good as or better than any kind of pleasure that we can get from outside. And because we have something, an alternative, we're less dependent on the things of the world. We become independent gradually of the things of the world. And that applies not only to sensual pleasures. As the mind finds deeper peace and happiness within, the mind becomes stronger, the heart becomes stronger. So in whatever situation, difficulties that we face in life, difficulties in relationship, ill health in the body, disappointments in our career, whatever comes along, the mind, the heart, is strong enough to hold those things, to deal with those things without being completely unbalanced. And this is the freedom that develops as we cultivate this path. In the beginning, it's a conditional happiness because it's dependent on concentration, on the levels of concentration. But as the momentum builds up, this stability of the mind is stronger and is less disturbed by the things that we encounter. It still can be disturbed, but it is less disturbed. And we're able to remain equanimous or to regain the balance of our mind much more quickly. Now, as we cultivate this particular path, as we become more familiar with the mind, then we develop wisdom, as I said. And the other path of practice, which is a gradual practice, just like the development of concentration, is the path of wisdom. And one of the aspects which we become more familiar with as the concentration develops is we start to see more clearly cause and effect in our own life. What produces my happiness and what produces my unhappiness? When the mind is in this state, what's the result? What's the consequence of saying or doing this thing? Living my life in this way. One of the effects of developing the mind through the calming, tranquilizing practices of samatha is that because the mind feels clearer and more spacious, whatever arises in the mind is able to be seen more clearly because it's more distinct. The mind isn't so crowded with everything that's going on. And so because of that, we're able to see things as they're coming, as we're in the middle of them, and the after effect. Instead of having a sense of everything falling on top of us at once, and we can't make head nor tail out of where it started and what led on to this or that, there's a sense of seeing things as they're coming, seeing them as they're happening, and seeing the results, the consequences of the choices we've made around that situation. Now, this aspect of wisdom is related to seeing everything as impermanent, nothing staying the same, nothing stable, things changing all the time. That's how things come and they go, because they do change, they are impermanent. And seeing that they are arising not just because of our desire, or not just because of one thing right now, but arising because of multiple causes and conditions. And some of those causes and conditions we only start to see clearly once the mind calms down. Once we've got this bigger screen, if you like, to watch what's going on in our life, to stand back from what's going on in our life and to see it instead of being in the middle of it all the time, overwhelmed by what's happening. To see things as arising because of multiple causes and conditions is to see conditionality, is to see what supports or gives rise to non-self. What is at the heart of non-self? At the heart of non-self is the idea that nothing exists on its own. Nothing happens just by itself. It always happens out of multiple causes and conditions. So just to be sitting here right now, we may say, well, I chose to sit here. It's an act of will. But you may have been deciding to come here, and at the last minute you get a call from a friend that says, who says, I'm arriving in 10 minutes to see you. I hope you'll be at home. You decided to come here and then you have to change your plans. You may be deciding to come here and there's a traffic jam and you're too late, or your car doesn't start, or any number of things can happen between the time of choosing to come and actually arriving. When we start to look at just one simple act, like coming here tonight, we see, yes, there's a choice there, but there are also many other factors impinging on whether or not I actually arrive. Our life is like that. And if we start to look closely to try to see which thing in all of that is actually not affected by something else, we look and we look and we look and we can't find anything that is unchanging and which arises just on its own. Now, a cause always has an effect, and that effect becomes a new cause. Once we start to calm the mind and settle the mind, we have a chance to see this, process of cause and effect happening in our life again and again. And in the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha points out to us, these are the causes that lead to the effect of happiness. These are the causes that you need to bring into your life if you want the result of peace of mind. We're very fortunate in the Buddha's teaching that we don't have to go looking for what do I have to do to find happiness? What do I have to do to work towards freedom? The Buddha lays it out for us very clearly. These are the causes that lead to happiness. But we have to not only know them, we have to do them. And we will only do them if we are convinced that these are the right causes for the effect that I want. This is what I need to do, and I'll be able to get the result. Now, to have that understanding is wisdom. And sometimes we start off just with a hope that it's going to be true, or just with a confidence but not really being sure, and then we have to put it into practice. And it has to be something that we do, and not just do from the outside, but do from the inside. just like following the tradition of giving, just because that's what we're supposed to do, without having our heart in it, and without knowing why we're giving, why it's an important part of our practice, and without learning from what we're experiencing while we try to put it into practice. Just following the Buddha's instructions without having that understanding, that wisdom aspect, so we know what we're doing, we won't keep up the practice. We won't continue with the practice. We won't get the results that we're seeking. So this wisdom understanding is very important. This is why the development of the mind in concentration has to go hand in hand with the development of the mind in wisdom. Now, I said I was going to link this with a teaching from one of the enlightened nuns. And now I'd like to read the story of one of the nuns from the time of the Buddha and just show you how this understanding of cause and effect is very important, and that it is important not just to do things from the outside, but to understand why we're doing them. What it is that's the purpose, and so we can see whether or not we're getting the promised result. Now, the nun that I'm going to read about is named Punika, and she was born as a slave in the time of the Buddha. She was born into the household of one of the Buddha's foremost disciples, Anathapindika. And slaves at the time of the Buddha in the society in that part of India weren't actually traded as chattel. It was more that they were born into a level, caste level, where they were considered to be suited for those kinds of jobs that particularly were menial tasks in the household, and that was their place in life. So Punika was born as the daughter of a slave into the household of Anathapindika, and it was very common for wealthy people at that time to have slaves who worked in their household. And Punika was a water carrier. Her job was to go down to the well or go down to the river and bring water back to the household. And this was the task that she had done throughout her life. Now, being born and being brought up in the household of Anathapindika meant that from the time that he became a disciple of the Buddha, and the Buddha came very often to give teachings to his family, to himself and his household, that Punika had the opportunity to hear the Buddha's teaching. And through hearing the Buddha's teaching, she attained the first stage on the path to enlightenment. She became a stream winner. Now, this is a very interesting play on the details of the story, that she was a water carrier and she attained stream winning. An interesting sort of play on her life situation. And having attained stream winning through hearing the Buddha's teachings, she became one who was absolutely convinced of the truth of the Buddha's teaching. Absolutely convinced that following the Buddha's teaching would take her to freedom. Now, as a slave, her freedom was limited. As a slave, she was like females in society generally at that time, that they were always considered to be under the guardianship of a male, whether it was father in the household or husband once a woman was married, and as a slave, the master of the household. So here she was, a slave in the household, but she had attained the first stage on the path to liberation. And so the story goes that after she had become a stream winner, she continued to practice in the household. She had the opportunity to hear the Buddha frequently, but she also recognized that this was the path to ultimate freedom. And so the teaching that we're going to hear from her took place before she actually left the household and went to take up the life of a nun. This is a story which occurs after the time that she had become a stream winner, but when she was still in the household life. And the story goes that she went down to the river on her usual task to bring back water. And down at the river, she met a Brahmin who was bathing in the water. Now, it is one of the beliefs of the Brahmins at the time of the Buddha and even today that bathing in the water is a way of purifying one's misdeeds and also purifying oneself if you've come in contact with anything that is impure. So even to come in contact with someone from the lower castes that one considers impure, one bathes immediately to remove that impurity. But this belief of being able to remove the effects of one's misdeeds through bathing in the river was the common view of the Brahmins. So here we have Punyaka going down to the river and meeting this Brahmin. And this is the conversation that took place. Punyaka says, "I am a water carrier. Even in the cold, I have always gone down to the water, frightened of punishment or the angry words of high-class women. So what are you afraid of, Brahmin, that makes you go down to the water? Your limbs shake with the bitter cold." So she has to go down there. It's part of her job. But what's he doing down there when it's so cold? And the Brahmin answers, "But you know why, Punyaka. I am doing good to prevent evil. Anyone young or old who has done something bad is freed by washing in water." And Punyaka replies, "Whoever told you you are freed from evil by washing? The blind leading the blind. In that case, all frogs and turtles would go to heaven, and water snakes and crocodiles and the rest of the water creatures. Butchers of sheep, butchers of pigs, fishers and trappers, thieves, executioners and other wrongdoers would be freed from their bad karma by washing in water. If these streams carried away all your old evil, they would carry away your virtue too. You would be separated from both. Don't do that thing, the fear of which leads you down to the water. Stop now, Brahmin. Save your skin from the cold." So she's saying that if it was true that water purified, then all the creatures who live in the water would be pure. And if it washes away your evil deeds, then it will wash away your virtue. So the whole logic of it is crazy. If you're fearful, don't do the thing that brings that fear. The Brahmin answers, "Lady, I was on the wrong road and you brought me back to the great road.
I will give you the robe I bathed in. And Punyaka replies, keep the robe, I don't want it. If you are afraid of pain, if you don't like it, do nothing evil, either openly or in secret. For if you do, even if you get up and run away, you won't escape its pain. If you are afraid of pain, if you don't like it, take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Train in the precepts. This is good. So Punyaka's teaching is, if you don't like the effect, don't do the cause. She knew for herself, because of her wisdom, that whatever you do on the outer doesn't matter. Any rites or rituals, following any traditions that don't relate to the cause, won't relate to the effect. One of the wisdom knowledges that comes from being a stream winner is that one no longer believes that rites and rituals will lead to enlightenment. One understands that acts of devotion like chanting and offering flowers are very good if they're done with a loving, devoted, grateful heart. But if they're just done for outer show, then their benefit is minimal. And in themselves, on their own, they won't lead to freedom. Freedom has to come from understanding, from wisdom. And the wisdom which she's talking about here is seeing cause and effect. If you do something that is hurtful, that's the cause. The effect will be that that effect will be of the same quality as the cause. What you get back is what you have given out. This is the law of karma. And if you want to purify, rites and rituals will not do it. We have to purify through the way that we live our life, the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we act. Punyaka knew this and understood it deeply. And so, as a result of her deep confidence in the Buddha and her wisdom, she went to the Buddha and asked to be allowed to become a nun. And the Buddha said to her that she would first have to get permission from Anathapindika, who was her master, her guardian, which is the all females at the time had to do if they wanted to become a nun. Anyone who wanted to join the monks' sangha, if they were indebted to the king or in service, they also had to get permission. If they were a slave, they had to be released from slavery. And when Punyaka went to Anathapindika and asked for her release, he said he would not only release her, he would treat her as he would his own daughter. And so she was sent off to be a nun. And these verses, which I've read out to you, were the verses that she repeated at her enlightenment to replay the story of how she had developed deep understanding of cause and effect, that if you want to get the result, you have to produce the causes. A deep confidence in the Buddha's teaching. Now, the point that I would like to make through this whole talk is whether we're thinking about Christmas and what we're doing with Christmas. If we want to make it a Buddhist practice, then whatever acts of generosity we have to see as something we do not just for the outer show, but from what we're doing from our heart. Watching the effect on the heart while we were engaged in it, and understanding that the benefit of giving is that it cuts across our self-centered craving. And cutting across our self-centered craving eventually makes it possible for us to turn away from the world, at least for the time of the meditation, and to find the happiness and peace that's available within the mind itself. Then we have something better than the happiness of the world, something that we can access at any time. And by developing that state of mind, we have a mind which is then capable of developing wisdom, understanding. And the wisdom and understanding which we need to develop is in terms of being able to discover for ourselves the truth of impermanence, the truth of nothing arising independently, but everything arising according to multiple causes and conditions, that the effect follows from the cause, not just from the outer appearance of things. Rites and rituals will not produce the result we want. We have to find the cause that produces the effect that we want. And we're better able to do that as we develop the mind in peaceful states in meditation. The story which I've just briefly touched on, the story of Punyaka, is to illustrate that the circumstances of our life don't dictate whether or not we can apply the Buddha's teaching to help us develop wisdom. And the circumstances of our life, which we may not like, may actually be something that contributes to our understanding. So, for example, if Punyaka being a slave, we might think, well, that would be a very unfortunate situation, but being a slave in the household of Anathapindika meant that she had access to the Buddha at close quarters and access to the teaching. So some of the things that which happen in our life which we don't like are the very things which propel us to look for a way out of suffering. Without those things happening, we'd still be seduced by the world into thinking that there we're going to find the answers to all our questions, the happiness that we seek. So not judging the outer show, but trying to use whatever situation we're in for our development of wisdom. The wisdom is what ultimately will bring freedom. But the freedom of the heart and the freedom of the wise mind go together. This is a part of the gradual training, a part of the practice that we all need to do, needs to be done as a complete package. So when we are looking for that complete package, the Noble Eightfold Path, Sila, Samadhi, Panya, the moral virtuous life, making meditation possible, through meditation, developing wisdom and understanding, which leads to freedom and liberation. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may this merit help us all to attain Nibbana. I was very keen also to add my support to the appeal. I was speaking to Scott just before we came in, and he was telling me that the orphanage has taken a loan to complete the girls' dormitory, and the extent of the loan in our terms is $1,500. I think you can see that in Bangladesh, a little bit of money goes a long way, and the money is used very wisely, very carefully for the needs of the children, and particularly for females in that society in that situation, they are particularly disadvantaged, and this is one of the places where the girls get the same kind of care and consideration and training that the boys receive. So I would encourage any of you who are interested to feel free to add to the donations tonight.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadehi Swakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namo.